scope from an Orthodox viewpoint, which I think you should find very, very interesting. So you can just go ahead and continue to eat, but I think it'd be well to go ahead. Since this, we weren't able to warn you, we realize that a lot of you do have time schedules, appointments, and so forth, but I did want you to have a chance to meet and hear Dr. Kaufman. So, Dr. Asher Kaufman, we give the podium to you.
It's a pleasure to be here with you today. On Tuesday, I think it was, I arrived in Washington from New York, and I was immediately whisked away to speak to, I think it's called the American Bible College near Washington. So I seem to have been whisked away from the airport to come and speak to you and say something to you. I'm not quite sure what you'd like to hear. By Washington time, I got up, I think, at 2 a.m., but don't worry about that. I'm still quite fresh. So if you'd like to ask me any questions, I try to answer as best as I can. Perhaps to say one or two words of introduction, I don't quite know what to say. Perhaps just to tell you that I started my work on the Temple Mount, research on the temple, in 1974-75. Perhaps I'll mention something which I don't think Lambert knows about, and very few people actually know about. But I think you'll appreciate what I'm going to say. I was due for a period of sabbatical leave, 1974-75, and I didn't quite know what to do. Being on the physics faculty of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, I was entitled to this leave of absence with pay, but my late parents had just arrived a few years before in Jerusalem, living not very far from us, and being very aged, they were entirely dependent upon me and my family. So I felt I couldn't leave the country, which is a traditional method of a person going sabbatical leave from Israel, to leave the country, go abroad. So I thought, what am I going to do? And there had been one or two ideas running through my mind since the reunification of Jerusalem in 1967. I prefer to say that rather than the Six-Day War. And I was attracted by the Temple Mount problem. If you remember with Moses in the burning bush, he saw a physical phenomenon without realizing what's going to happen, without realizing that there's going to be the confrontation with God. And I myself, perhaps in the same way, smaller way, felt about the temple that the Dome of the Rock isn't the site of the temple. Just something in me felt that there's something queer here. And so I was attracted to the problem, just as many other people were attracted to the problem that particular time. Because before then, the temple area was just like being as far away as the moon. Virtually so. And there were one or two ideas. Being a physicist, I thought of the idea of detecting sacrificial blood in the soil in the Kidron Valley. You may know it's given in the tractate Midot dimensions of the Mishnah that the blood from the altar drained away to the Kidron Valley. So the idea was a very simple one of attempting to detect the sacrificial blood. As a physicist, seemed a very simple idea, but a very difficult problem. And that's how I started in 74-75. But although I did think of this idea, I didn't quite think of attempting it. Sometime, I think it was in 73, June 73 or July 73, I was in the synagogue in the morning for the morning service, quite early in the morning, about 6:30 at the time. And at the end of the standing prayer, what we call the Amidah, there's a reference to the rebuilding of the temple. A small prayer, right at the very end, asking that the temple should be rebuilt. And as I was saying this particular piece, which is a standard formula, you might say, you're also used to standard formula in prayer, intertwined with what I was saying, there came, as it were, the message, if you can use that word, that I should spend sabbatical leave working on this problem. And so I decided that's what I've got to do. It's fixed for me. And so that's how the ball started rolling. Well, I've said something already in about 5 minutes, so perhaps you'd like to carry on from there yourselves. Those of you who've read the BER article, which was published a few months ago, may realize what has taken place since then. Professor Biran, who was at the time the director of antiquities in Israel, I approached him shortly after this episode, which I mentioned to you a moment ago, not immediately, but fairly soon afterwards, and he said to me, "You're looking for a pin in a haystack." I think he was right when I look back on it. I saw him after the BE article was published, and he said, "Well, you've come a very long way." Not that I necessarily agree with everything you write. So we've come all that way, and maybe you'd like to ask me some questions about the article or the whole question of the Temple Mount. By the East Gate, do you mean the present Golden Gate or the East Gate of the Temple in ancient times? Well, thank you for your question. I would say the following. I'm pretty sure this is right. The present Golden Gate defines, with the gate below it, defines the position of the Eastern Gate from First Temple times. I wouldn't go so far as to say from Solomon himself, but certainly from the time of the kings, time of the First Temple. About the actual gate below the Golden Gate, I wouldn't like to be sure whether this is Solomonic or from the First Kings. There might even be another gate underneath that. But certainly the position is exact to within about a meter. What is very interesting, which was not mentioned in the BE article, is this, that a scholar called Rabbi Haparchi, 650 years ago, wrote a book called Kaftor Faferach. If you remember, with regard to the menorah, the lamp in the temple, in the tent of meeting, that it had buttons, as it were. I don't know how it's translated into English. The word is kaftor, and also floral arrangements. So he used this particular phrase, kaftor faferach. And this book is a most interesting book because it is a combination of geography, as he saw it, with Talmudic references interlinked. And he gives you a description of the eastern wall of the Temple Mount. He saw the Golden Gate. He mentions the two big arches of the Golden Gate. And he says that this gate is from Solomonic times. I think what he meant was that the position of the gate is from Solomonic times, or from the kings, from the First Temple. So here you have a person who had some kind of ancient tradition giving you some information about this particular place. What is very interesting too, that instead of worshipping by the Western Wall, as Jewish people are doing today, the Jewish people went to the Eastern Wall and went to this very place. He mentioned this explicitly. I'm convinced. I wouldn't dare to come here or to publish the BE article if I weren't convinced. There's a phrase in Psalms. I'll say it first in Hebrew, part of a verse, and then I'll translate it. I think there's a young man, at least one young man in the audience who will know right away what I'm saying. I spoke to him in Hebrew a few moments ago. Sod Hashem Liriav. The secret of God is given to those who are God-fearing. So I'm convinced it's right. There may be one or two things which are not completely correct in the temple plan. Lambert here will call them in physics notation second order corrections. There are one or two second order corrections which have to be made, which I'm aware of at the moment, but they won't change the exact position of the second temple or the first temple to within about 10 centimeters, 4 inches. And I say this in all modesty. The third temple will be rebuilt. I can't... I can't tell you when. But what I can say about the temple research is most interesting. Those of you who are aware of the reading of the law, the five books of Moses in the Jewish style, that we have a portion of the week read on the Sabbath, and attached to this is what's called an additional portion, because there was a time when enemies attempted to forbid the reading of the Torah, reading of the law, so they read this additional portion from, say, the prophets. And this particular week, if I'm not mistaken, the last verse is from Isaiah and says, in its own time, I will hasten it. And this will happen with the third temple. I know this from the research. Sometimes within a minute, you've advanced meters. Big jumps are made within minutes. And you have to work on this. This is what happened, say, with regard to the first temple, the layout of the first temple, a year and a half ago. I wasn't aware of the details of this, and suddenly something clicked, and with a little bit of hard work, the plan came out. So I think maybe the same thing will happen with the third temple. We may say today, in our presence here, we don't know when, and maybe something will happen very quickly, and we'll find it can be built. You may realize, I don't know whether, a lot of Jewish people don't realize it themselves, that Maimonides, who was that great scholar and physician in the 12th century, born 1135, died 1204, he said it is a positive commandment to build the temple. Presumably when the temple existed, he could mean adding to it, repairing it. But when it doesn't exist, it has to be built. You have this statement in Exodus. And so, even to the present time, according to him, without any conditions, it should be built. Some people will say we have to wait for the Messiah. But according to Maimonides, the simple statement in Exodus, one should build a temple. First of all, it was a tent of meeting. Then the first temple, second temple, so the third temple should be built in the same style as, same basic style as the older ones. I think there's more interest gradually. I know that for giving a lecture on the subject, I've been asked to give many lectures over the course of years. I try to space them out about once a fortnight, not to impose too much upon myself, and I found I've been able to keep to the schedule quite well, sometimes even putting people off. I think it happened once for what we call Jerusalem Day, the day when Jerusalem was reunited. I think a year ago or 2 years ago, I had four lectures in one day, and one of them in the middle of the night. So I haven't been able to compete quite as well on this occasion coming to Washington. Washington had two in one day. I hope I'm not worrying you too much by... I just can't see all the faces at one time, so I'm maybe not keeping to the right order, so I hope you don't mind if I take somebody before another person. All good questions. I wouldn't be sure. When people ask me, I say, well, when is a building, when do you start building a building? And usually one says, well, first of all, you start actively by setting out the architect's plans. You've already started once you've got the architect's plans. I would claim that we already have these plans. So we've already started building. No. I agree. This is where I fail. I can only do things on the whole in two dimensions. I can't use my imagination for three dimensions. I hope the others don't mind my answering further this particular point. There's a young man called Ranyakir who comes from General Kibbutz in Israel. You know about the kibbutz. And about a year ago, he, since you mentioned Dr. Fleming, at his advice, he came to me and asked for information about the temple because he wanted to build a model, three-dimensional model of the temple for his high school work. There's an arrangement whereby instead of sitting a particular examination, you can prepare a paper and some aspect of, I think, Jewish history. He wanted to prepare a model on the temple. He was given, allowed this, and Dr. Fleming actually happened to be his promoter or something like that. And he came to me many times also on the telephone, and he has built this model. It's a wonderful model. I think it's the most accurate model available today. He incorporates some of the things that I told him about the shape of the Heichal, for example, and the outer court, which you would call the court of the Gentiles. So if anybody gets to Israel, he should go to the kibbutz called Tel Yosef. Tel Yosef, the Tel of Yosef. And it's now in the school and see this model. It was given a little bit of publicity in the press recently by the Department of Education, saying how this method of examination is a wonderful method of promoting initiative and enterprise on the part of young people. So here you have the three-dimensional model. I myself, I think he was very bold because he had to decide things in three dimensions, which I myself today wouldn't have the courage perhaps to do so because I would say, I don't know. It's a very difficult question. I don't want to link at the moment the physical temple, the building of the temple, with the sacrificial order. For Jewish people, there are two separate commandments of the 613 commandments. Building the temple is a mitzvah, ordinance on its own right. And I haven't myself gone into the whole question of sacrificial order. But since you mention something about spirituality, I want to give you one reason why I think the temple should be built. And these are thoughts which have come out over the period of the research, just like Moses with the physical seeing of the burning bush didn't realize what's going to happen. Likewise, what I'm telling you now is something which wasn't born at the beginning. It wasn't a motive for doing the temple research. Let us take Mount Sinai, or Mount Sinai as I prefer to call it, the revelation there. In the Bible, in Exodus, we're told, why did this take place? It could have been given on paper or cuneiform. It took place because it should instill in the people a sense of fear of God, that they shouldn't sin. In Hebrew, man lo techitau, that they shouldn't sin. The tent of meeting was a mobile Mount Sinai. There's a commentator called Nachmanides who, in his introduction to the book of Numbers, gives you this idea, lovely idea, that the tent of meeting is this mobile Mount Sinai. From the tent of meeting, we go to the first temple.
from the second temple we go to the third temple. That we need a third temple that for Jewish people, for mankind as a whole, there should be instilled in them this fear of God. And a physical entity, because we're part of physical reality, a physical entity, I think, could help in this direction. And just being here in the United States a few days strengthens this idea. I have a cousin in New York, and on the, you call it here, the freeway, he said to me, people today don't think about God. They do things without thinking about him. And I think Ray the other day, also on the freeway round about Washington, said to me almost exactly the same thing. So I think there's a definite need for a temple to instill in all peoples this fear of God as we have the world as it is today. I don't know whom to choose. I've got a feeling that somehow that hand was up quite a long time, if I may say so, right at the end. Let's see if I can remember your two questions. there is a tradition, a strong Jewish tradition, that the temple should be built on its original site because the land is sacred. The land there has been sanctified. And hence, the people who came from Babylon and built the second temple, if you remember, they built the altar first, they built it on the same site. And I don't think any Jewish person today could say rightly that it should be built anywhere else, simply because the land there is sanctified territory. Perhaps for the second temple people, when they came back, there was a practical implication as well, because it seems quite obvious now from the research that they used the old foundations to a certain extent. They saved themselves a lot of work. In particular, those who have read this article in BER, the Northwest, the rock mass which I speak about, which I wrote about, served both first and second temples. Now, coming to your second question, this is what I said before. One doesn't know when the temple will be built. About a holy war, I'm not convinced that the Muslims would react in this way, provided everything is done carefully and diplomatically. They've got to realize themselves that they have endangered their own position, because there's a definite decline of Islamic sanctity of the area. To them it's sacred, but there has been over the last 170 years approximately that I know of, a decline of Islamic sanctity. And perhaps one should play on this to a certain extent. I can give you many examples of what I mean. So when somebody wrote to me the other day, connected with the BIA article, that he offered, first of all, some help in a voluntary capacity, person in the United States, to make drawings, because he's an artist and draftsman. When I wrote to him, accepting his offer without being able to offer anything definite in paper, he wrote to me a second time, about a month ago, and said that he now declines his offer because he is afraid of a holy war and things like that. And I wrote to him the other day and said that you decline your offer doesn't worry me one bit, but I'm a bit concerned about your reasons for doing so. And I gave him more or less what I said just now. I think that if things are done carefully and diplomatically, then one shouldn't worry too much. And after all, the area will be for all peoples. The Dome of the Rock hasn't got to be pulled down as some people thought it should be. Can stand side by side. Now, yes, okay. I'm not sure that I know what you're talking about. All I would say about the so-called rabbinical tunnel, it is in Warren's enumeration tank or cistern number 30, which he planned over 100 years ago. We know this from his maps of the area. The outer court, maybe I'm not answering your question directly because I can't, but this may be interesting in connection with the so-called rabbinical tunnel. The outer sanctified court of the temple, which you would call the court of the Gentiles, had a kind of trapezoid shape. I use the word trapezium, but you would call it, I think, United States trapezoid shape. The southwest corner, I don't know whether you can visualize this, the southwest corner of this trapezoid pretty much coincides with the position of the rabbinical tunnel. And this may be just pure coincidence, but maybe not. Why? Because there were five gates to the outer sanctified court, the court of the Gentiles. Five gates above ground. But in each corner, there were four corners, there was posted a Levi, Levite. And they were watchmen. So why should they be posted there as watchmen? There must have been some kind of exit or entrance to the Temple Mount, that particular place. And we know there must have been subterranean tunnels, because when a priest became unclean, he could make his exit by one of these subterranean tunnels. So there is a possibility, just an idea, that maybe this tunnel or cistern was one of those exits which was guarded by the Levite in those ancient times. And what I've written down for myself is to go over all the literature, all the references to this tunnel in Warren's books and the like, to see if there's any reference about something going in further within the Temple Mount. That's all I can say at the moment. Well, another good question. About the temple research in general, you mean? I've been helped by all strata, many strata of Israel society. It's amazing the number of people, when they've asked to cooperate, have cooperated in a voluntary way. When I've had to have special mapping, of course I've paid for this through professional agencies like the Survey Department of the Israel government. And even they, on one occasion, did something free. When I wanted a quick aerial photograph, because I saw something very interesting, I went to a commercial firm called Pantomap, who do aerial survey, but they also have their own flights. And I couldn't come forward with, say, 4,000 or 10,000 shekels for the flight. So they said, they'll do it for me. They're going to have a flight further north. On the way, they'll photograph the area. So with regard to the actual research, people have helped me without any trouble at all. In fact, got very enthusiastic about it in some cases. With regard to audiences, I've been asked by many audiences to come forward and speak to them, and I found that people are very interested and enthusiastic to listen to the lecture. Whether this means something practical is another story, but there is enthusiasm. There are two aspects to this. One is a down-to-earth aspect, which is the policy of the scientist, the physicist, or the chemist, and Lambert can confirm this to you, being a physicist like myself. With regard to the Second Temple, two different methods give exactly the same position with an uncertainty of, say, 10 centimeters. Maybe 5, but I'm prepared to say within 10 centimeters. And these two methods are quite independent of one another, based upon certain assumptions, it's true. And I would say it's most unlikely that this would be the result if it were just pure chance. That's down to earth. And secondly, there's a kind of spiritual aspect where you have a message which says to you, this is the right answer. The two go together. There's a phrase, you may not appreciate it very easily, I'll try to explain it. In Hebrew it's easier to understand. In Deuteronomy, I don't go by chapters, I go by portion readings. So it's difficult for me to tell you which chapter it is. But it's a part dealing with the place where God will place his name. I think you'll begin to realize what I'm talking about. And there's a phrase there which says, Lishichno tidreshu uvata shama. You will seek out his presence and come there. Now, there's a much later tradition which says that people will seek out, this is after, obviously, after the destruction of the second temple, people will seek out the place of the temple and you will come there. But in Hebrew there's a difference between the plural and the masculine. It says tidrushu shama in the plural. In other words, many people will attempt to find the place of the temple. Uvata shama, and you will come there, is in the singular. Only one person will get there. I think there was another, this gentleman. Yeah, did you want to? No, okay. You're telling me something new. Even the United States, one learns things about there. I don't know whether I've answered questions to your liking, but I've tried my best.
It's been a joy to meet with you fellows again today, and we will be notifying you of our next monthly meeting. And as I said, Samuel Goldfoot will be our guest towards the end of September. He'll be here. And it should be a very exciting meeting. I think it's one that you'll enjoy very much. It's just about time now. In fact, already in Israel, the Shabbat has begun. And they usually break down early for Shabbat on Friday afternoon to prepare for it and all. And so we know that Dr. Kaufman is interested in getting settled for the Shabbat. And so we wish to say to him a very pleasant Shabbat Shalom. And it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. It's been our joy to have you fellows with us and to share today. And we're looking forward to these fellowships sort of on a monthly basis where we just get together, and we'll be having varied speakers. It just so happens that the first three are Israeli nationalists, but it does provide some very interesting materials for our own understanding of the present day situation and the feeling of the people, which feelings we find so akin to our own that it becomes exciting. I was interviewed by a reporter from the Jerusalem Post at a meeting where Samuel Goldfoot and I were together. We were at the same table and in conversation with each other. And he said, "How is it that you, a radical Christian, have any relationship with Samuel Goldfoot, a radical Jew?" And I said to him, "Well, first of all, I don't consider myself a radical Christian. I do consider myself a Christian, but I don't really classify myself as radical. But I said, as a Christian, I believe that the Bible is the Word of God. And I believe that the Bible teaches that that the temple is to be rebuilt. That Ezekiel even gave measurements and dimensions. And that this temple, from an eschatological standpoint, was to be rebuilt in the last days. And so I said, I find men like Samuel Goldfoot, who is so determined for the temple to be rebuilt, I find it very interesting to me as a Christian to find this in the heart of the people. Now, I said, I don't know when it is to be rebuilt. I don't know what the circumstances will be, whether or not it will even be in our time. I don't know for sure. But yet to find this intense interest in the hearts of these people makes them very close to me, because I do also desire to see the temple rebuilt. And whether or not this is the time, I don't know, but at least I find it very interesting, and thus I find myself very interested in men like Samuel Goldfoot, and I have no problem getting along with him quite well. And so, because we do have common interest, and the same with Dr. Kampfman, we have these common interests, and it just so happens that he shares my opinion for the site, and that's what makes him so interesting to me. And his theories are so interesting to me, because he has come to them from more or less the spirit and science, and I've come to the same conclusions from the spirit and the Bible, using just the Bible and what it says concerning the temple and so forth, the descriptions by Ezekiel and by John in the book of Revelation. I've come to the very same conclusions that he's come to, and so I find it very fascinating to me that coming from different directions, we both land at the same spot. And so it's fascinating to me from a biblical scholar's standpoint, and him coming from the physicist and the wealth of the Hebrew material that he is able to read and decipher and understand, and to have him come to the very same place, the same spot, and the same conclusions, I find it very fascinating. I think it's one spirit working in both of our hearts, you see. And thus it becomes exciting from that standpoint. So thanks, fellas, for being here. May the Lord be with you, bless you, and prosper you in your ministries, and you'll be notified of our next meeting as soon as we get the date set down tight with Samuel Goldfoot. Then in the future, we'll be having Chuck Missler share some with us on some eschatological viewpoints. That Chuck is always exciting and fascinating. He always has something new that he's pulled out of his computer. And so looking forward to just great times together in the future, as on a monthly basis we will try and get together just to share in these times of information, fellowship, love, prayer, searching together, seeking together for the perfect will and plan of God to be accomplished in our lives and then through our lives in our various fellowships. So thanks for coming, and God bless and be with you. Shabbat Shalom.